so this is a talk about how we can enforce that web applications follow some reasonable security policies. So I wanted to start out by looking at a prefix of a popular online resource called the OAuth Top 10. It's a compilation by some security experts of the most important classes of security vulnerabilities from a risk standpoint. So probably not surprisingly, near the top of this list, we see different variations on the idea of code injection attacks, where your application is going to unintentionally run some program supplied by a user. There's been some great work on preventing these kinds of attacks. They're actually relatively easy to avoid if you build in support in your programming language or your web framework. Things get a little harder when you look at the next few entries on the list, things like broken authentication schemes or insecure direct object references, where someone can handcraft a URL that manages to get around your authentication scheme. So dealing with these kinds of problems, in some sense, really requires understanding what your application means to do, what your authentication scheme is, and so on. And this talk, I want to tell you about one approach that I've been working on for doing that kind of checking. So first, let me give you some examples of these more semantically rich security bugs. I have pulled a few snapshots out of the National Vulnerability Database from July 2010. Here's one that says there was an application that would allow attackers to bypass the authentication mechanism by setting a particular cookie to the value 1. So this seems like the kind of thing that we'd like to be able to prevent, but we do clearly need to have some kind of idea of how the application is supposed to work to be able to tell that this is a problem. Here's another example of an application which would allow attackers to bypass some intended restrictions and muck with the user database by handcrafting URL that somehow triggered an unexpected path in the program execution and got around some authorization. And here's another very similar problem, which says we have an application which will allow anyone effectively to change anyone else's password by handcrafting URL that happens to contain name value pairs for new password 1 and new password 2. So when I look at problems like this, to me it brings to mind my impression of how security is generally taken into account when these applications are designed. So in particular, the developers try to think hard about what are all the attack vectors that they need to worry about, and then they make sure to audit each of these possible vectors and make sure that it can't actually lead to a problem. There's maybe a sort of more principled approach where you try to avoid the possibility of being blindsided by an attack that you just happen not to think of, and instead you come up with some kind of security policy that talks directly about the resources that you're interested in protecting instead of trying to enumerate the ways that those might be compromised. And so that's what I want to talk about now. In particular, I'm focusing on information flow properties that control who is allowed to learn what properties of the data in this resource, and access control properties that are governing who is allowed to change the data in particular ways. There have been a lot of great projects that do this kind of thing already, with a few broad approaches. One of these is dynamic checking, where, let's say, for the example of information flow, we have some kind of database that contains some sensitive information that can flow through the different variables of some application program and might eventually be output to the user. And if the user hasn't been authorized to view this data, then we want to make sure that flow like this is not possible. And one way to do that with dynamic checking using techniques like taint tracking is to instrument the program so that every one of these variables stores not just the original value, but also some metadata that gives the security information for each one of these variables. And so when we actually get to the point where the program could interact with its environment, we just have to check that the metadata of the information we're sending out says that this is okay to send. The dynamic checking approach has both some upsides and some downsides. On the upsides, it turns out to be relatively easy to add to existing programs, especially in scripting languages. And you get a fair amount of flexibility in implementing different kinds of security policies because you can more or less just write programs in the language you're using to enforce different checks. There are also some downsides. For instance, like all dynamic program analysis, you're only going to find bugs for program paths that you think to test. So there might be some kind of corner case that you miss and only gets discovered in the field. There's also a significant performance overhead in instrumenting programs to store all this extra information. So then, on more of the static checking front, there are some well-established ideas like security types, which will do something similar to taint checking, but in the compiler instead of at runtime, where if you're using a language like Java, every one of your program variables already has a type on it. And we can make these types a little more informative and change them to include security information, like which values are high or low security. And then we can consider all the different paths through the variables in the program that might lead to the user and enforce that whenever data can flow from one variable to another, this respects some kind of subtyping relation, where high security is definitely not a subtype of low security. And in this way, we can get the compiler to statically check these properties for us. And one of the good things about switching to static checking is that we can be sure that we've checked all possible program paths at compile time, and we don't need to modify the runtime behavior of the program at all, which includes not adding performance overhead. The downsides include that generally the programmer has to work a little harder to get this kind of technique to work by adding annotations like these more expressive types. And it can be hard to write down certain useful security policies because we have to shoehorn all of our policies into this type system, which isn't that much more expressive than the normal, say, Java type system. So in this talk, I want to tell you about a new analysis that I've been working on. It's called Erflow. It's so far implemented for a new programming language that I've been developing called Erweb. And I've tried to take some of the best qualities of both of the traditional dynamic and static approaches. So like dynamic checking, Erflow doesn't require any extra program annotations. And it has a very flexible security policy language, which I also hope will be accessible to a large body of web developers, because security policies are written as SQL queries. And I'll go into more detail about how that works very soon. And Erflow is a static analysis, so it inherits the usual benefits of static analysis, like checking all program paths statically and not adding any runtime overhead. So I just wanted to say a word about this programming language that I'm using before I go on. This is the only slide where I'll show code in that language. This is a new language I'm developing from the ground up to try to make the right choices about programmer productivity and security for web applications. So the only relevant property of the language for this talk is that there's integrated parsing and type checking of SQL queries. So in some sense, the compiler understands how you're using the database, which makes it possible for the compiler to tell you if you're using the database in the wrong way. So not only are we analyzing programs that use a database, we'll also adopt a kind of database idiom to specify how the programs are supposed to behave. So here's a simple example of a security policy. Let's say that we have a database table with three columns. This table represents some secret information. Each row has an ID, a name, and the actual secret value. And we could write this policy at the lower right here to express the idea that the application is only allowed to tell clients the ID and name fields of rows in this table. The secrets have to not be disclosed. So at this point, this looks like the SQL idea of views, where we can define derived queries and say clients may only access the views directly. They can't go to the underlying data. And then we can use usual database access control mechanisms to implement this. Erflow goes further and lets you write policies that are sort of user-specific. So here's an expansion on that example. Let's add a new column to this table called code. This is supposed to be a secret code that you have to know to be granted access to the secret. So we can write this slightly more complicated policy, which says that it's OK to disclose the full contents of any row in the database if the client can prove that it knows the code for that row. So intuitively, the definition of this known predicate is that it holds of any value that the client must already be aware of based on the HTTP request that the client sent to us. So to get a little more specific about that, there are sort of three kinds of things that we start out assuming the client knows. First, we assume that the client has the full source code to the application. And to simplify things, let's say that the client knows every constant that appears in the source code, so things like string literals and integer constants. The client generated a page request by doing something like submitting a form in HTML, so we can assume that the client knows the value of every one of the form fields in the request. And finally, there might be some HTTP cookies involved, say one that represents authorization information as a pair of a username and a password. So let's take all these values and use them as the base of our set of values that we can assume are known to the client. We can also do some sort of predictable computations on these values to build derived values, like taking some of these and forming them into new tuples. We'll assume that any of these predictable operations preserve knownness. And we can also deconstruct values into their components and then use those to produce new compound values and so on. So this is the basic idea, which I hope is a reasonable one, of what we can assume that the client knows. So this idea turns out to be pretty general and useful for expressing a variety of authentication and authorization policies. So here's a standard kind of password authentication. Let's take the secrets table and give it a new column owner, which references a database table of users, where each user has a password. And so we can write a policy which is controlling access to the secret table, but is expressed in terms of a join with the users table. So this policy is effectively saying it's OK to release any information this query could return. In particular, that means it's OK to release the secret field of some row of the secrets table if this row is owned by a particular user's row and the client has demonstrated that it knows the password of that user. So a lot of policies like this show up when you're using password authentication. So we don't just want to write policies. We also want to check them. And the Airflow analysis does this statically. And the basic idea is to use some sort of formal logical modeling of what the server knows is true at every point in executing the code for a web application. So here I have some pseudocode for a common pattern that you would see in a password-based web application. So we read the current value of an authorization cookie to get out a username U and a password P. Then we select the real password of this user from the database. We check whether that password matches the provided password. If not, then we abort. Otherwise, we'll do some more computation and then select all of the secrets out of the database that are owned by the authenticated user. And we can run a loop over sending those secrets to the client as HTML. So at each point in executing this program, there are some things that we know are true. For instance, right after we read the cookie, we know that these U and P values are known to the client because they came from a cookie which the client sent us. And then after we check that the database password matches the provided password, we know there must exist some tuple U in the users table whose ID and password fields match the fields of the cookie. And finally, when we get around to actually sending data to the client in a loop down here, we know that for any value V that might be sent here, there must exist some tuple S in the secrets table that is owned by the current user, and where the value we're sending is actually equal to the secret part of that tuple. So I've just taken first-order logic and used it to express all of the reasonable assumptions that we would get if we were sort of thinking through executing this program. And the nice thing about writing things down in a logical notation is that we can try to get an automated theorem prover to deduce things about this representation. So let's take all of these pieces of information and plot them together into a sentence of first-order logic. And so we have a formula which is basically expressing the things that are true at a particular point in program execution. And we also have this security policy, which says you may release information about secrets that are owned by users whose passwords the client knows. And we can translate that into first-order logic as well by saying for any tuple S from the secrets table and U from the users table, if S is owned by U and the password of U is known, then you are in fact allowed to release the secret field of the tuple S. And so we have this combined formula, which basically says everything we know at this point. And now all we have to do is prove this mathematical theorem that for any value V that might be sent, it is in fact allowed to be sent. And that, take my word for it, that follows from the usual rules of first-order logic from what we have written here. So to zoom out and get have a look at the bigger picture of this, the two inputs to the analysis in general are your program code implementation and the security policies, which are written as SQL. And you can once and for all translate the security policies into sentences of first order logic. And then to analyze the particular program, the first step is to take it and divide it into a finite set of finite execution paths. And you can read the paper for the details of how that works. It takes advantage of some recurring patterns in web applications where they're not quite as infinite as programs are in general. And so you have this finite set of paths where you need to consider each one of them exhaustively. And we do that with symbolic execution like the example that I was just showing you. So for each one of these paths, we're stepping through every one of the instructions in it. And at each point, we have a logical predicate which expresses what is true at that point. And at some points, an action is performed which might violate the security policy. For instance, we might try to send some data back to the user. Each one of these possibly disallowed actions has associated with it a predicate, which I'm writing as Q here in a separate column. So basically, we have to check that every one of these check predicates is really true. So for every one of the lines of this execution, we just fire up the automated theorem prover and take the predicate that expresses what we know is true at this point, and that together with all of our security policies, and ask the theorem prover whether that implies that the check predicate for the action is really true. And I'm simplifying things here a little because, in general, first-order logic with quantifiers is undecidable. So some of this quantifier reasoning has to be pushed into the analysis itself. And you can see the paper for exactly how that works. So the approach supports a wide variety of security policies that you'd actually want to use in web applications. For instance, here's an example of a web message forum that uses an access control list to control who's allowed to do what in which forums. So we have this ACL table, which is tuples of forums, users, and numeric levels that specify how much access they've been granted. And we can write a security policy, which does a three-way join across these three tables and says it's okay to release the body of a message if there exists an ACL entry whose forum matches the forum where this message is found, and the ACL user entry matches some real user whose password is known, and finally the level of access granted is greater than or equal to some threshold. So this policy will even work for applications that perform no joins at all, because the automated theorem proving will understand the semantics of queries and will sort of reconstruct the join behavior from sequences of simpler queries that show up in the natural implementation. And the same general approach will also work for checking database modifications. So here's an example of a policy that authorizes certain inserts into the secrets table. It looks a lot like those policies for information flow, except in the from clause of the SQL query, one of the tables is tagged with the name new. So we're authorizing inserts into the table that we write as new. And the particular conditions here are saying you may insert into secrets if the owner field of the record you're creating matches some user whose password you know, and you also know the particular secret value that you're sending. And this last part will hopefully block some unintended information flows from more privileged parts of the database. And there are variants of this same approach for update and delete commands from SQL too. So I have implemented this analysis for the compiler for my programming language, Urweb, and put together a few case studies of representative kinds of web applications. There's a simple database of secrets that I've been using for motivation for some of these examples. There's an online polling application. There's a reusable user database component, which I then use in the next three case studies, which are a calendar, a web form, and a gradebook for a class. And for each of these, I've listed the number of lines of code in the main implementation of the application, and also the number of lines of code for writing these SQL security policies. So the ratio between those isn't so bad, but it's not as good as it would probably be in a production application, because I haven't spent much time on creating fancy user interfaces for these applications. So I would expect that in the field, these programs would have many more lines devoted to fancy interfaces, while the policies would stay more or less the same. And there's also another column in this table showing how long the current compiler takes to check adherence to the security policies for each one of these examples. For most of these numbers are all right. For one of these, the check is starting to take a long time. And that's really because I haven't spent any time implementing any of the standard program analysis optimizations here to do things like avoid considering redundant paths. So I hope that applying some of those standard techniques would get all of these numbers down to pretty reasonable levels. So I just want to wrap up by saying why I'm excited about this project. I work in programming languages research, and people who do that kind of thing are often telling software practitioners that they should stop using all of these legacy imperative languages that are just too hard for compilers to analyze. And this means that we can't use compilers to help programmers understand their programs better and to avoid certain kinds of bugs. And the practitioners generally aren't so interested in following this advice. They'd rather just go back to coding their web applications in Ruby on Rails or other popular languages. Except that these applications quite commonly are doing almost nothing interesting besides running SQL queries. And SQL is one of the most successful declarative languages that has exactly these analyzability advantages that people in the programming languages world are excited about. So we can take advantage of a case where there's lots of real code that is already being written in a very declarative way and is very close to being ready to pass off to this Airflow program analysis and check things automatically for security and get very close to feeling like you've gotten a free lunch. The main thing is that so far this is just implemented for my prototype programming language, Urweb. I think it should only be a little harder to adapt these ideas to work for more mainstream languages. In languages that don't have integrated SQL support, you'll have to do some kind of work to understand the use of strings or so forth in a program and map that up to a higher level view where you can apply this theorem proving. But I'm hopeful that will work out pretty well. And I will just stop here by pointing you to this URL where you can get the latest compiler for this language, which includes the analysis that I've been talking about. Thanks.
Questions?
Hi, Aaron Pendergrass from Johns Hopkins APL. This is really great work, but one of the things that anyone who's worked with SE Linux knows is that writing good policies is hard too. Do you have any intent of doing an analysis on policies to show that they're achievable or that rules don't open up more access, that they're consistent with each other?
The question of whether policies are achievable seems like you've answered it if you manage to check a program that uses those policies. Right?
By achievable, I mean that the data can actually be accessed by someone.
So the analysis is never going to change the behavior of your program. So if your program passes the analysis and you haven't included any checks in your program that are going to block access, then you should be in good shape. What was the other part of the question?
Just the different fragments of policy are consistent with each other and not opening up indirect paths to gaining knowledge that someone might not want to leak out.
Yeah, it seems like a hard problem, and I'm not sure I necessarily have an answer. It's just I like to think that the code auditor's job is made easier by moving to a declarative format instead of thinking about many code paths.
Josh Triplett, Portland State University. I was wondering, the nice thing about throwing all of these generated paths at a theorem prover is that it's really easy to get the logic through to say, okay, is this valid or not? The downside is that the diagnostics, which seem like one of the most important pieces of a static analysis tool, are somewhat less than optimal. And I'm wondering, to what extent can your program give a better answer than just yes, it's secure, or no, it isn't, and in particular things like if you checked these things, it would be okay, or you know, you're very close to being secure except for this one piece of this security rule. Is that the one you forgot?
Right.
Can you help me make the program secure, not just tell me it isn't?
So when the analysis thinks it detects, a place in the program where the information flow policy is violated, it will say, at this point, so it will say, here's the instruction that I think might be wrong. Here are all the facts I know about the program state at that point. And it can be hard to tell which of those facts are relevant and which aren't. But it's at least a static view of a problem instead of forcing you to think about the dynamic behavior of the program. I think that's the best answer I have now.
Do you have any particular plans for how to improve the diagnostics at all, or how you could make it help the programmer more?
There's probably some kind of heuristic for filtering out facts that aren't likely to be relevant, but I haven't thought much about the details.
Okay, thanks.
Mehul Shah, HP Labs. So security policies and security permissions and so on, they grow in organizations, they grow organically, right? You know, somebody puts one in, not sure what that one was for, but I'm going to add a little bit more, right? Or I might change a field here and there. Can you comment on, in your particular framework, whether this helps or makes the problem worse?
Well, I've definitely written applications and had policies that I later decided were actually too permissive, and I've added extra policy pieces, and then the application just continues checking. It seems like this should be a useful tool for cases where policies are continuously evolving, because you get this kind of automated sanity check that you haven't added something that contradicts what your code is already doing.
Okay. I'm just worried about the policies getting a bit too cumbersome to actually understand. I mean, SQL statements tend to sort of grow, and then people don't understand them. They just keep lopping stuff on.
So this language does support writing essentially macros that encapsulate common patterns of queries you'd like to write. And if you have a lot of different instances of the same domain, that can really shrink down the size of the policy you need to read.
Thanks.
I'm Toshiyuki Maeda from University of Tokyo. And I have a very, very silly one question. And is this your work is related to something like model checking approach of the secure information flow, or some kind of security automata analysis on the type based approach? And besides generating the policy from some SQL usage, or besides such point, is there any theoretical difference or new things?
So a lot of the techniques I'm using are a lot like techniques used in software model checking. And some of the main new things are reasoning about what the client knows, and the idea of using SQL policies as a convenient way of expressing your intentions to the theorem prover.
You mean that the usually SQL usage or something is have some plenty of information for exploit utilize in such this kind of secure information flow, then your approach can be applied to other kind of approach like type analysis or model checking.
I haven't seen any type systems that are able to reason about things like a security policy that changes as certain tables in your database change. That certainly works fine here, so I'm not sure.
It cannot be directly applied, but it's just the idea. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, one more question.
Günsü, Cornell University. Typically, security policies refer to exogenous facts that are not codified in the database. So these might take the form of event A happened before event B. They're temporal in nature. Or they might refer to pieces of state that are not in the SQL database itself. Have you thought about how you would handle these cases?
You can do some temporal things by expanding your database to store state fields. So I've done that for examples like you can create a poll, you can mess with it until it's live, but once someone has voted on it, the security policy prevents further changes.
Those are integrity checks, right? That if that was easy to do, they typically people build it into SQL itself, into their database configuration itself. So typically those things are not in the database, these things that you have to come post facto and try to enforce.
I definitely haven't done any implementation work that, that handles state outside of the database and cookies. It's also worth looking into, definitely.
Great, thanks.
Okay, let's thank Adam once more.